Side 7, Nemesis by Isaac Asimov, continuing on page 240. I tried to call out, but in the shock of the situation, I couldn't manage to make a sound just at first. I tried to get to her quickly to run to her, put in Daubuisson. Yes, but you found you couldn't run. You were almost in a state of paralysis, am I correct? Gunnar nodded. Yes, rather. I tried to run, but did you ever have one of those nightmares where you are pursued and somehow you can't manage to make yourself run? Yes, we all have those. It usually comes when we have managed to tangle our arms or legs in the bedclothes. It felt like a dream. I managed to get my voice at last and shouted at her, but without the E-suit, she couldn't hear me, I'm sure. Did you feel faint? Not really. Just helpless and confused, as though it were not even any use in trying to run. Then Marlena saw me and ran toward me. She must somehow have recognized I was in trouble. She didn't seem to have any trouble running, is that right? I wasn't aware that she was. She seemed to reach me. Then we... I'll be honest, Renée, I don't remember after that. You came into the dome together, said Daubuisson calmly. She was helping you, holding you up. And once in the dome, you collapsed, and now here you are. And you think I have the plague. I think you experienced something abnormal, but I can find nothing in your brain scan, and I am puzzled. There you have it. It was the shock of seeing Marlena in danger. Why should she be taking off her E-suit if she weren't... He stopped abruptly. If she weren't succumbing to the plague, is that it? The thought crossed my mind. But she seems fine. Would you like to sleep some more? No, I'm awake. Scan and see to it that it comes out negative because I feel much better now that I have the story off my chest. And then I'm going about my business, you harpy. Even if the brain scan is apparently normal, Commander, you'll stay in bed for at least 24 hours. For observation, you understand? Gunnar groaned theatrically. You can't do that. I can't lie here and stare at the ceiling for 24 hours. You won't have to. We can set up a viewing stand for you so that you can read a book or enjoy holovision. You can even have a visitor or two. I suppose the visitors will be observing me, too. It's conceivable they may be questioned on the matter. And now we'll set up the brain scan equipment again. She turned away, then turned back with a smile that softened slightly at the edges. It's very possible you're all right, Commander. Your reactions seem normal to me. But we must be sure, mustn't we? Gunnar grunted, and when Daubuisson turned again and walked away, he made a face at her straight back. That, he decided, was a normal reaction, too. 60. When Gunnar opened his eyes again, it was to see Eugenia Insigne gazing at him sadly. He looked surprised and began to sit up. Eugenia! She smiled at him, but that did not make her face look less sad. She said, They said I could come in, Seaver. They said you were all right. Gunnar felt a wave of relief. He knew he was all right, but it was nice to hear that his opinion was confirmed. He said with bravado, Of course I am. Brain scan normal, asleep. Brain scan normal, awake. Brain scan normal, forever. But how's Marlena? Her brain scan is perfectly normal, too. Even that did not lighten her mood. As you see, said Gunnar, I was Marlena's canary, as I had promised. I was affected by whatever it was before she was. And then his mood changed. It was no time for banter. He said, Eugenia, how can I excuse myself to you? I wasn't watching Marlena to begin with, and I was too paralyzed with horror to do anything afterward. I failed completely, and did so after my telling you with such confidence that I would take care of her. Honestly, I have no excuse. Insigne was shaking her head. No, Seaver, it was in no way your fault. I'm so glad she brought you in. Not my fault? Gunnar felt dumbfounded. Of course it was his fault. Not at all. There's something much worse than Marlena foolishly removing her suit, or you being unable to act quickly. Much worse, I'm sure of it. Gunnar felt himself turning cold. What's much worse, he thought. What are you trying to tell me? He swung himself out of bed and suddenly became aware of his bare legs and of the totally inadequate gown he was wearing. He hastily draped the light blanket around himself. He said, Please, sit down and tell me. Is Marlena all right? Are you hiding something about her? Insigne sat down and looked solemnly at Gunnar. They say she's all right. The brain scan is entirely normal. Those who know about the plague say she shows no symptoms. Well, then, why are you sitting there as though it's the end of the world? I think it is, Seaver. Of this one. What does that mean? I can't explain. I can't reason it out. You have to talk to Marlena to understand. She's going her own way, Seaver. She's not upset over what she did. She insists that she cannot properly explore erythro. Experience erythro is the phrase she uses, with the E-suit on, and she has no intention of wearing one any longer. In that case, she won't go out. Oh, but Marlena says she will. Quite confidently. Whenever she wishes, she says. And alone. She blames herself for having let you come with her. She's not callous over what happened to you, you see. Over that, she is upset, and she was glad she reached you in time. Really, there were tears in her eyes when she talked about what might have happened if she hadn't walked you into the dome in time. Doesn't that make her feel insecure? No. That's the oddest part of it. She's now sure that you were in danger, that anyone would have been in danger, but not she. She is so positive, Seaver, I could... She shook her head, then muttered, I don't know what to do. She's a positive girl by nature, Eugenia. You must know that better than I do. Not this positive. It's as though she knows we can't stop her. Perhaps we can. I'll talk to her, and if she pulls any of this, you can't stop me when she talks to me, I'll just send her back to Rota, and at once. I was on her side, but after what happened to me outside the dome, I'm afraid I'm going to have to be tough. But you won't. Why not? Because of Pitt? No, I mean you just won't. Gunnar stared at her, then laughed uneasily. Oh, come. I'm not that much under her spell. I may feel like a kindly uncle, Eugenia, but I'm not so kindly I'll let her walk into danger. There are limits, and you'll find that I know how to set them. He paused and said ruefully, We seem to have changed sides, you and I. Before today, it was you who insisted on stopping her, and I who said it couldn't be done. Now it's the other way around. That's because the incident outside has frightened you, and the experience since then has frightened me. What experience since then, Eugenia? I tried to set the limits after she was back in the dome. I said to her, Young lady, don't you dare speak to me like that, or far from not being able to leave the dome... You won't be able to leave your room. You'll be locked in, tied up if necessary, and back to Rota we'll go on the first rocket. You see, I was wild enough to threaten her all the way. Well, what did she do? I'm willing to bet a large sum she didn't burst into tears. I suspect she gritted her teeth and defied you, right? No. I hadn't even gotten half the words out when my teeth started chattering and I couldn't speak. A wave of nausea swept over me. Gunnar said, frowning, Are you about to tell me that you think Marlena has some strange hypnotic power that can prevent us from opposing her? Surely that's impossible. Have you ever noticed anything like that in her before this? No, of course I haven't. I don't even see this in her now. She has nothing to do with it. I must have looked quite ill at the moment I was threatening her, and that clearly frightened her. She was very concerned. She couldn't possibly have caused it and then reacted so. And when you two were outside the dome and she was taking off her E-suit, she wasn't even looking at you. She had her back to you. I was watching, and I know that. Yet you found you couldn't do anything to interfere with her, and when she realized you were in trouble, she flew to your assistance. She couldn't have deliberately done that to you and reacted in that fashion. But then, I'm not through. After I had threatened her, or rather, after I had failed to threaten her, I scarcely dared say anything to her that wasn't perfectly superficial. But you can be sure I kept my eye on her and tried not to let her see I was doing that. At one point, she talked to one of your guards. You have them all over the place. In theory, muttered Gunnar, the dome is a military post. The guards merely maintain order, help out when needed. Yes, I dare say, said Insigna with a touch of contempt. That's Janus Pitt making sure he has a way of keeping you all under observation and under control, but never mind. Marlena and the guard talked for quite a while, seemed to be arguing. I went to the guard afterward, after Marlena was gone, and asked him what Marlena had talked to him about. He was reluctant to say, but I squeezed it out of him. He said she wanted to arrange some sort of pass that would allow her to leave and re-enter the dome freely. I said to him, What did you tell her? He said, I told her that would have to be arranged at the commander's office, but that I would try to help her. I was indignant. What do you mean you would help her? I said, How could you offer to do that? He said, I had to do something, ma'am. Every time I tried to tell her it couldn't be done, I felt sick. Gunnar listened to all of this stonily. Are you telling me... that this is something Marlena does unconsciously, that anyone who dares contradict her is made ill? And that she doesn't even know that she is responsible for it? No, of course not. I don't see how she can be doing anything at all. If this were an unconscious ability of hers, it would have made its appearance on Rotor, and it never happened there. And it isn't just any contradiction. She tried for a second helping of dessert at dinner last night, and quite forgetting that I didn't dare cross her, I said sharply, "No, Marlena." She looked terribly rebellious, but subsided, and I felt in perfect health, I can tell you. Now, I think it's only in connection with Erythro that one can't contradict her. But why do you suppose that should be, Eugenia? You seem to have some notion or other about this. If I were Marlena, I would read you like a book and tell you what that notion is, but since I am not, you must tell me. I don't think it's Marlena at all who's doing this. It's the planet itself. The planet. Yes, Erythro. The planet. It's controlling Marlena. Why else should she be so confident that she is immune to the plague and that she will come to no harm? It controls the rest of us, too. You came to harm when you tried to stop her. I did. The guard did. Many people came to harm in the early days of the dome because the planet felt it was being invaded, so it produced the plague. Then, when it seemed you were all content to remain within the dome, it let go, and the plague stopped. See how it all fits in? Do you think, then, that the planet wants Marlena out upon its surface? Apparently. But why? I don't know. I don't pretend to understand it. I'm just telling you how it must be. Gunnar's voice softened. Eugenia, surely you know the planet can't do anything. It's a lump of rock and metal. You're being mystical.
I am not.
Seaver, don't slip into this trick of pretending that I'm a silly woman. I'm a first-class scientist, and there's nothing mystical about my thinking. When I say the planet, I don't mean the rock and metal. I mean that there's some powerful permeating life form upon the planet. It would have to be invisible, then. This is a barren world with no sign of life above the prokaryote, let alone intelligence. What do you know about this barren world, as you call it? Has it been properly explored? Has it been searched through and through? Slowly, Gunnar shook his head. He said with a pleading note in his voice, Eugenia, you're drifting off into hysteria.
Am I, Seaver?
Think it out yourself and tell me if you can find an alternate explanation. I tell you the life on the planet, whatever it is, will not have us. We're doomed. And what it wants with Marlena, her voice quavered, I can't imagine. Chapter 28. Takeoff. 61. Officially, it had a very elaborate name, but it was spoken of as Station 4 by those few Earth people who had occasion to mention it. From the name, it was at once apparent there had been three such objects earlier, none of which were any longer in use, having been cannibalized in point of fact. There was also a Station 5 that had never been finished and had become derelict. It is doubtful if the vast majority of Earth's population ever thought of the existence of Station 4, which drifted slowly around Earth in an orbit well beyond that of the Moon. The early stations had been Earth's launching pads for the construction of the first settlements, and then, when the settlers themselves took over the job of building settlements, Station 4 was used for Earth's flights to Mars. One such Martian flight was all that took place, however, for it turned out that the settlers were far better suited psychologically to long flights, living as they did in worlds that were large and closed spaceships, and Earth left it to them with a sigh of relief. Station 4 was now rarely used for any purpose and was maintained only as Earth's foothold in space, as a symbol that the settlers were not the sole owners of the vastness beyond Earth's atmosphere. But now, Station 4 had a use. A large cargo ship had lumbered out in its direction, carrying with it the rumor among the settlements that another attempt, the first in the 23rd century, would be made to place an Earth team on Mars. Some said it was merely for exploration, some for the establishment of an Earth colony on Mars in order to bypass the few settlements in orbit around the planet, and some for the purpose, eventually, of establishing an outpost on some sizable asteroid that no settlement had yet claimed. What the ship actually carried in its cargo hold was the superluminal and the crew that was to propel her to the stars. Tessa Wendell, even though she had been planet-bound for 8 years, took the space experience calmly as any settler by birth would naturally do. Spaceships were far more like settlements in principle than they were like the planet Earth, and because of that, Crow Fisher, though he had been on many a spaceflight before, was a bit uneasy. This time, something more than the unnaturalness of space contributed to the tension on board the cargo ship. Fisher said, I can't endure the waiting, Tessa. It's taken us years to reach this point, and the superluminal is ready, and we still wait. Wendell regarded him thoughtfully. She had never intended to get this involved with him. She had wanted moments of relaxation to rest a mind overcome with the complexity of the project so that it might return to work refreshed and keener. That was what she had intended. What she had ended up with was something much more. Now she found herself helplessly tied to him so that his problems had become hers. The years of his waiting would surely come to nothing, and she worried about the despair that would follow his inevitable disappointment. She had tried to dash cold water on his dreams judiciously, tried to cool down his overheated anticipation of a reunion with his daughter, but she had not succeeded. If anything, over this past year, he had grown more optimistic about the possibility for no obvious reason, at least none he would explain to her. Tessa was finally satisfied and relieved that it was not his wife Crowell was looking for, but only his daughter. To be sure, she had never understood this longing for a daughter he had last seen as an infant, but he had volunteered no explanation, and she had not wanted to probe the matter. What was the use? She was certain that his daughter was not alive, that nothing on Rotor was alive. If Rotor was there near the neighbor star, it was a giant tomb drifting in space, wandering forever, and undetectable except by incredible coincidence. Crowell Fisher would have to be kept steady and functioning once that inevitable prospect became clearly apparent reality. Tessa said cajolingly, "There's only a 2-month wait left, at most. Since we've waited for years, another 2 months won't hurt." "It's the waiting for years that makes even 2 months more unbearable," muttered Fisher. "Tell yourself otherwise, Crow," said Wendell. "Learn to bow to necessity. The Global Congress simply won't allow us to go any sooner. The settlements have their eyes on us, and there's no way of being sure that they all accept the notion that we're heading for Mars. It would be strange if they did, considering Earth's poor record in space. If we do nothing for 2 months, they will assume we're having trouble, something they would readily believe and find satisfaction in, and withdraw their attention." Fisher shook his head angrily. "Who cares if they know what we're doing? We'll be off and gone, and they won't duplicate superluminal flight for years, and by that time we'll have a fleet of superluminal vessels and be moving rapidly forward toward opening up the galaxy." "Don't take that for granted. It's easier to imitate and overtake than it is to originate, and Earth's government, considering its dismal record in space after the settlements reached maturity, is obviously anxious to establish unmistakable priority for psychological reasons." She shrugged. "Besides, we need the time to carry out more tests on the superluminal under low-gravity conditions." "There's never any end to tests, is there?" "Don't be impatient. This is so new and untried a technique, and so unlike anything humanity has ever had, that it is all too easy to think of new tests, especially since we are a little uncertain as to the manner in which moving into and out of hyperspace is affected by the level of intensity of a gravitational field. Seriously, Crowell, you can't blame us for being cautious. After all, as recently as a decade ago, superluminal flight was considered theoretically impossible."
"Even caution can be overdone."
"Possibly. Eventually, I will decide that we've done all we can reasonably be expected to do, and then we'll take off. I promise you, Crowell, we won't wait unreasonably. I won't overdo caution."
"I hope not." Wendell looked at him doubtfully. She had to ask. She said,
"You know, Crowell, you're not yourself lately. For the last 2 months, you've seemed to be burning up with impatience. For a while there, you had cooled down, and then you suddenly gained excitement again. Has something happened that I don't know about?"
Fisher calmed suddenly.
"Nothing's happened. What can possibly have happened?"
To Wendell, it seemed he had calmed down too quickly, had wrenched himself into a most suspicious affectation of normality. She said,
"I'm asking you what can possibly have happened. I've tried to warn you, Crowell, that we are not likely to find Rotor a functioning world, or find it at all. We are not likely to find any of its inhabitants alive."
She waited through his stubborn silence, then said,
"Haven't I warned you of that possibility?"
"Often," said Fisher.
"Yet you sound now as though you can hardly wait for what is sure to be a happy reunion. It is dangerous to have hopes that are not likely to be fulfilled, to pin everything upon them. What has suddenly produced this new attitude? Have you been talking to someone who was unjustifiably optimistic?"
Fisher flushed.
"Why do I have to have been talking to someone? Why couldn't I have come to an independent conclusion concerning this or any other matter? Just because I don't understand the theoretical physics that you do understand doesn't mean I'm subnormal or brainless." Wendell said. No, Cryle, I never thought anything of the sort about you, nor did I mean to imply it. Tell me what you think about Rota. Nothing terribly deep or subtle. It just seemed to me that there was nothing in empty space that is very likely to have destroyed Rota. It's easy to say that there might only be the dead hulk of a settlement at Rota if it reached the neighbor star at all, but what is it that would have destroyed them either on the way or once they were there? I defy you to give me a specific scenario of destruction. Collisions, alien intelligences, whatever. Wendell said earnestly, Cryle, I can't. I have no mystical visions of something having happened. It's just hyper-assistance itself. It's a tricky technique, Cryle, take my word for it. It doesn't use either space or hyperspace in a steady way, but skids along at the interface, wobbling to one side or another for short periods, and moving from space to hyperspace, and then from hyperspace back to space several times a minute, perhaps. The passage from one to the other may therefore have taken place a million times or more in the course of the trip from here to the neighbor star. And so? And so, it happens that the transition is far more dangerous than is level flight in either space or hyperspace. I don't know how thoroughly the Rotorians had established hyperspatial theory, but the chances are that they had done so in only a rudimentary fashion, or they would have surely developed true superluminal flight. In our project, which has worked out hyperspatial theory in great detail, we've managed to establish the effect on material objects of passing from space to hyperspace and vice versa. If an object is a point, there is no strain on it during the transition. If an object is not a point, however, if it is an extended bit of matter, as any ship would be, then there is always a finite period of time during which part of it is in space and part is in hyperspace. This creates a strain. The amount of strain depending on the size of the object, its physical makeup, its speed of transition, and so on. Even for an object the size of Rota, the danger involved in a single transition, or a dozen for that matter, is so small that it can reasonably be ignored. When the superluminal will travel, superluminously, to the neighbor star, we are liable to make a dozen transitions, or possibly only as few as two. The flight will be a safe one. In a flight with hyper-assistance only, on the other hand, there may be a million transitions in the course of the same trip, you see, and the chances of fatal strain mount up. Fisher looked appalled. Is the chance of fatal strain certain? No, nothing is certain. It's a statistical matter. A ship might undergo a million transitions, or a billion, with nothing happening. It might be destroyed, on the other hand, on the very first transition. The chances, however, increase rapidly with the number of transitions. I suspect, then, that Rota embarked on its trip understanding very little about the dangers of transition. Had they known more, they would never have left. There is a very good chance, then, that they experienced some sort of strain that might have been weak enough to allow them to limp to the neighbor star, or one that was strong enough to blow them completely out of existence. Therefore, we might find a hulk, or we might find nothing at all. Or we might find a settlement that has survived, said Fisher rebelliously. Admit it, said Wendell. Or we might ourselves be strained against the odds, be destroyed, and for that reason find nothing. I ask you not to be prepared for certainties, but for probabilities, and remember that those who think about the matter without some accurate knowledge of hyperspatial theory are not likely to come to reasonable conclusions. Fisher fell into a profound and clearly depressed silence while Wendell watched him uneasily. 62. Tessa Wendell found Station 4 a weird environment. It was as though someone had built a small settlement but fitted it out to be a combination of nothing more than a laboratory, an observatory, and a launching platform. It had no farms, no homes, none of the appurtenances of a settlement, however small. It was not even equipped with a spin that would set up an adequate pseudo-gravitational field. It was, in fact, nothing but a spaceship with acromegaly. It was clear that although it could be permanently occupied, provided there was a continuous drizzle of food, air, and water supplies, there was some recycling, but it wasn't efficient, no single individual could remain there for very long. Cryle Fisher made the wry comment that Station 4 was like an old-fashioned space station from the early days of the space age that had unaccountably survived into the 23rd century. In one respect, though, it was unique. It presented a panoramic view of the Earth-Moon system. From the settlements that orbited Earth, the two bodies could rarely be seen in their true relationship. From Station 4, however,
Earth and Moon were never more than 15 degrees apart, and as Station 4 revolved around the center of gravity of that system, roughly equivalent to revolving about the Earth, the changing pattern of the two worlds, both in position and phase, and the changing size of the Moon, depending on whether it was on the station's own side of Earth or on the opposite side, was a never-ending wonder. The Sun was blocked out automatically by the Artec device, Wendell had to ask to find out that stood for Artificial Eclipse Device, and only when the Sun moved too near either Earth or Moon in the station's sky was the view spoiled. Wendell's settlement background showed up now, for she enjoyed watching the Earth-Moon interplay, mostly, she explained, because it made it clear she was no longer on Earth. She said as much to Fisher, who smiled dourly. He had noticed her quick glance to right and left as she said it. He said, I see you don't mind telling me that, even though I'm an Earthman and might resent it. But never fear, I won't pass it along. I'd trust you with anything, Kryl, she smiled at him happily. He had changed considerably since that crucial conversation when they had first reached Station 4. He was somber, yes, but sooner that than the feverish expectation of what could not be. He said, do you really think they resent you being a settler at this stage of the game? Of course they do. They never forget. They're as narrow-minded as I am, and I never forget their Earth people. You obviously forget I'm an Earthman. That's because you're Kryl, and fall into no category other than Kryl. And I'm Tessa, and that ends it. Fisher said thoughtfully. Does it ever bother you, Tessa, that you have worked out superluminal flight for Earth rather than for your own settlement, Adelia? But I haven't done it for Earth, and I wouldn't have done it for Adelia in other circumstances. In both cases, I'm doing it for myself. I had a problem to solve, and I completed the job successfully. Now I'm going down in history as the inventor of superluminal flight, and that's what I've done for myself. And it may sound pretentious, but I'm doing it for humanity, too. It doesn't matter on which world the discovery is made, you know. Some person or persons on Rotor invented hyperassistance, but we have it now, and so do all the settlements. In the end, the settlements will all have superluminal flight, too. Wherever an advance takes place, ultimately, all humanity is helped. Earth needs it more than the settlements do, though. You mean because of the approach of the neighbor star, which the settlements can easily evade by leaving, if necessary, but which Earth can't? Well, I'll leave that as a problem for Earth's leaders. I've supplied the tool, and they can work out methods for using it to their best advantage. Kryl said, I understand we're taking off tomorrow. Yes, finally. They'll be taking holographic recordings and give us the full treatment. There's no way of telling, though, when they'll be able to release them to the general public and the settlements. It can't be till after our return, said Fisher. There'd be no sense in putting them on display if they can't be certain we'll ever come back. It's going to be an agonizing wait for them, too, since they'll have no contact with us at all. When the astronauts first landed on the Moon, they were in touch with the Earth all the way. True, said Wendell. But when Columbus sailed off into the Atlantic, the Spanish monarchs never heard from him again till he returned 7 months later, Fisher said. Earth now has far more at stake than Spain had 7.5 centuries ago. It is really a great pity we can't have superluminal communication since we have superluminal flight. I think so, too. As does Korapatsky, who has been hammering at me to work out telecommunication. But as I told him, I am not a marvelous supernatural force who can crank out everything anyone needs. It is one thing to push mass through hyperspace, and quite another to push some sort of radiation through hyperspace. They follow different rules, even in ordinary space, so that Maxwell didn't work out his electromagnetic equations until 2 centuries after Newton worked out his gravitational equation. Well, mass and radiation follow different rules in hyperspace, too, and the rules for radiation still defeat us. Someday we'll work out superluminal communication, but we haven't yet. It's too bad, said Fisher thoughtfully. It's possible that without superluminal communication, superluminal flight won't be practical. Why not? The lack of superluminal communication cuts the umbilical cord. Could settlements live far from Earth, far from the rest of humanity, and survive? Wendell frowned. What's this new line of philosophy you've begun to track down? Just a thought. Being a settler, Tessa, and being accustomed to it, it may not occur to you that living on a settlement is not truly natural to human beings. Really? It never seemed unnatural to me. That's because you weren't really living on one. You were living in a whole system of settlements, among which one was a large planet with billions of people on it. Might not the Rotorians, once they reached the neighbor star, find that living on an isolated settlement was unsatisfactory? In that case, they would surely return to Earth, but they haven't. Might that not be because they have found a planet to live on? A habitable planet circling a red dwarf star? Most unlikely. Nature has a way of fooling us and upsetting supposed certainties. Suppose there is a habitable planet there. Shouldn't it be carefully studied? Wendell said, "Ah, I'm beginning to get what you're driving at. You feel that the ship may come to the neighbor star and find that there is some sort of planet there. We would then make a note of it, decide from a distance that it is uninhabited, and go on about our task of further exploration. You would want us to land and make a much more thorough search so that we can at least try to find your daughter. But what if our neuronic detector finds no trace of intelligence anywhere within any planetary system the neighbor star may have? Must we still search the individual planets?" Fisher hesitated. "Yes. If they show any signs of being habitable, we must study them, it seems to me. We must know all we can about any such planet. We may have to begin evacuating Earth soon, and we must know where to take our people. It's all very well for you to overlook that, since settlements can just drift off without the necessity of evacuate." "Kryle, don't start treating me as the enemy. Don't start suddenly thinking of me as a settler. I'm Tessa. If there is a planet, we'll investigate it as much as we can, I promise you. But if there is, and if the Rotorians are occupying it, then... Well, you spent some years on Rota, Kryle. You must know Janus Pitt."
"I know of him. I never met him, but my wife... My ex-wife worked with him. According to her, he was a very capable man, very intelligent, very forceful."
"Very forceful. We knew of him on other settlements, too. And we were not generally fond of him. If it was his plan to find a place for Rota that was hidden from the rest of humanity, he could do no better than to go to the neighbor star, since it was so close and since its existence was not known by anyone outside Rota at the time. And if, for any reason, he wanted a system all to himself, he would, being Janus Pitt, fear the possibility of being followed and having his monopoly upset. If he happened to find a useful planet that could be used by Rota, he would be even more resentful of intrusion."
"What are you getting at?" asked Fisher, who looked perturbed as though he knew what she was getting at.
"Why, tomorrow we take off, and in not too long a time, we'll be at the neighbor star. And if it does have a planet, as you seem to think it might, and if we find the Rotorians are occupying it, it's not going to be a matter of just going down to the surface and saying, 'Hello, surprise.' I'm afraid that at the first sight of us, he would give us his version of a hello and blast us into oblivion."
Chapter 29. Enemy. 63. René d'Aubusson, like all the inhabitants of the Erythrodome during their period of habitation, visited Rota periodically. It was necessary, a touch of home, a return to the roots, a gathering of renewed strength. This time, however, d'Aubusson had moved upward, the usual phrase for passing from Erythro to Rota, a bit earlier than her schedule had called for. She had, indeed, been summoned by Commissioner Pitt. She sat in Janus Pitt's office, noting with her skilled eyes the small signs of aging that had accumulated since she had last seen him several years before. She did not, in the ordinary course of her work, have frequent occasions to see him, of course. His voice, however, was as strong as ever, his eyes as sharp, and she noted no decline in mental vigor. Pitt said, "I have received your report on the incident outside the dome, and I recognize the caution with which you approached your diagnosis of the situation. But now, off the record and unofficially, exactly what happened to Gunnar? This room is shielded, and you can talk freely." D'Aubusson said dryly, "I'm afraid that my report, cautious as it was, happens to be truthful and complete. We don't really know what happened to Commander Gunnar. The brain scan showed changes, but these were extraordinarily small and did not correspond to anything in our past experience. And they were reversible, since they did, in fact, quickly reverse."
"But something did happen to him."
"Oh, yes, but that's the point. We can't say anything more than something."
"Some form of the plague, perhaps?"
"None of the symptoms that have been detected in the past were found in this case."
"But in the old days of the plague, brain scanning was still comparatively primitive. You would not have detected the symptoms you have detected now in the past, so it might still be a mild form of the plague, might it not?"
"We could say so, but we could not present real evidence to that effect, and in any case, Gunnar is now normal."
"He seems normal, I suppose. But we don't really know if there might not be a relapse. Neither is there any reason to suppose there might be. A fleeting look of impatience crossed the commissioner's face. You're sparring with me, d'Aubusson. You know perfectly well that Gunnar's position is one of considerable importance. The situation in the dome is always precarious, since we never know if and when the plague will strike again. Gunnar's value was that he seemed immune to it, but we can scarcely consider him immune now. Something happened, and we must be prepared to replace him. That is your decision to make, Commissioner. I am not suggesting replacement as a medical necessity. But you'll keep him under close observation, and you'll keep the possibility of such a necessity in mind, I hope.
I would consider that part of my medical duties.
Good. Especially since if there is to be a replacement, I have been considering you.
Considering me?
A small flash of excitement crossed her face before she could suppress it.
Yes. Why not? It's well known that I've never been enthusiastic about the project of colonizing Erythro. I have always felt it necessary to retain the mobility of humanity and not to allow ourselves to be trapped into slavery to a large planet again. Nevertheless, it would be wise if we could colonize the planet, not as a place intended primarily for population, but as a vast resource, rather as we treated the moon in the old solar system. But we can't do that if the plague hangs over our heads, can we?
No, we can't, Commissioner.
So our real task, to begin with, is to solve that problem. We never have. The plague just died down, and we have accepted that. But this latest incident shows us that the danger is not yet gone. Whether Gunnar suffered a touch of the plague or not, he certainly suffered something, and I want the matter now given top priority. You would be the natural person to head that project.
I would be glad to accept the responsibility. It would mean doing what I am, in any case, trying to do, but with greater authority. I hesitate at supposing that I ought to be the Erythro Dome commander.
As you said, that's for me to decide. I take it you would not refuse the post if it were offered to you.
No, Commissioner. I would be greatly honored.
Yes, I'm sure, said Pitt dryly. And what happened to the girl? For a moment, d'Aubusson seemed taken aback by the sudden change in subject. She all but stammered as she repeated,
"The girl?"
"Yes, the girl who was outside the dome with Gunnar, the one who removed her protective suit."
"Marlena Fisher?"
"Yes, that's her name. What happened to her?"
d'Aubusson hesitated. "Why, nothing, Commissioner."
"So it says in the report. But I'm asking you now."
"Nothing? Nothing detectable by brain scan or in any other way?"
"You mean that at the same time that Gunnar, wearing an E-suit, was struck down, the girl, this Marlena Fisher, without an E-suit, suffered nothing?"
d'Aubusson shrugged. "Nothing at all, as far as we could tell."
"Don't you consider that strange?"
"She's a strange young woman. Her brain scan..."
"I know about her brain scan. I know also that she has peculiar abilities. Have you noted that?"
"Oh, yes, I have indeed."
"And how do her abilities strike you? Mind reading, by any chance?"
"No, Commissioner. That's impossible. The concept of telepathy is a mere fantasy. I wish it were mind reading, in fact, since that would not be so dangerous. Thoughts can be placed under control."
"What is it about her that is more dangerous?"
"Apparently, she reads body language, and we can't control that. Every motion speaks."
She said it with a touch of bitterness that Pitt did not fail to note. He said, "Did you have a personal experience of that?"
"Certainly."
d'Aubusson looked grim.
"It is impossible to be near the young woman without experiencing some of the inconvenience of her habit of perception."
"Yes, but what happened?"
"Nothing of tremendous importance, but it was annoying."
d'Aubusson flushed, and for a moment her lips pressed together as though she were thinking of defying her interrogator. But that moment passed. She said, almost in a whisper,
"After I had examined Dome Commander Gunnar, Marlena asked me how he was. I told her that he was not seriously harmed, and that there was every hope that he would recover completely."
She said,
"Why does that disappoint you?" I was taken aback and said, "I'm not disappointed, I'm pleased." She said, "But you are disappointed. That is quite clear. You're impatient." It was the first time I had encountered that sort of thing directly, though I had heard about it from others, and I couldn't think of anything to do but challenge her. Why should I be impatient? For what? She looked at me solemnly with her large, dark, and unsettling eyes. Then she said, "It seems to be about Uncle Seaver."
Pitt interrupted, "Uncle Seaver? Is there a relationship?"
"No, I think it's only a term of affection." She said, "It seems to be about Uncle Seaver, and I wonder if you want to replace him as Dome Commander." At that, I just turned and walked away.
Pitt said, "How did you feel when she told you this?"
"I was furious, naturally."
"Because she had maligned you? Or because she was correct?"
"Well, in a way..."
"No, no, don't hedge, Doctor. Was she wrong or was she right? Were you sufficiently disappointed at Gunnar's recovery for the girl to notice? Or was the whole thing a stroke of her peculiar imagination?" The words seemed to force themselves out of d'Aubusson's lips.
"She sensed something that was really there."
She stared at Pitt defiantly.
"I'm only human, and I have my impulses. And you yourself have now indicated that I might be offered the post, which would seem to mean you consider me qualified for it."
"I'm sure you are maligned in spirit, if not in fact," said Pitt without any sign of humor. "But now consider. You have this young woman who is peculiar, who is very strange, both as shown by the brain scan and by her behavior, and in addition, she seems unaffected by the plague. Clearly, there may be a connection between her neuronic pattern and her plague resistance. Might she not be a useful tool for studying the plague?"
"I can't say. I suppose it's conceivable."
"Shouldn't it be tested?"
"Perhaps. But how?"
Pitt said quietly, "Let her be exposed to the influence of erythro as much as possible."
D'Aubusson said thoughtfully, "That is what she wants to do, as it happens, and Commander Gunnar seems to be willing to let her."
"Good. Then you will supply the medical backing."
"I understand. And if the young woman gets the plague?"
"We must remember that the solution of the problem is more important than the welfare of a single individual. We have a world to win, and for that we might have to pay a sad but necessary price."
"And if Marlena is destroyed, and that does not help us understand or counteract the plague?"
Pitt said, "That risk must be faced. After all, it might also be that she will remain untouched, and that that untouchability, carefully studied, may give us the means of a breakthrough in understanding the plague. In that case, we win without loss."
It was only afterward, when d'Aubusson had left for her Rotorian apartment, that Pitt's iron resolution permitted him to think of himself as Marlena Fisher's confirmed enemy. True victory would be to have Marlena destroyed and the plague remain unsolved. At a stroke, he would be rid of an inconvenient girl who might otherwise someday produce young like herself, and of an inconvenient world that might otherwise someday produce a population as undesirable, as dependent, and as immobile as Earth's population had been. 64. The three of them sat together in the erythrodome, Seaver Gunnar watchful, Eugenia Insigna deeply concerned, and Marlena Fisher clearly impatient. Insigna said, "Now remember, Marlena, do not stare at Nemesis. I know you've been warned about the infrared, but it's also a fact that Nemesis is a mild flare star. Every once in a while, there's an explosion on its surface and a burst of white light. It just lasts a minute or two, but that will be enough to shock your retinas, and you can't tell when it's going to happen."
Gunnar said, "Can astronomers tell when it's going to happen?"
"Not so far. It's one of the many chaotic aspects of nature. We have not yet worked out the rules underlying stellar turbulence, and there are some among us who think the rules can never be worked out entirely. They are simply too complex."
"Interesting," said Gunnar.
"It's not that we're not grateful to the flares. 3% of the energy reaching erythro from Nemesis is the result of those flares."
"That doesn't sound like much."
"It is, though. Without the flares, erythro would be an icy world and much less easy to live on. The flares do make problems for Rotor, which has to adjust its use of sunlight quickly whenever there's a flare and strengthen its particle absorption field."
Marlena was looking from one to the other as they spoke, and she finally broke in with a small note of exasperation.
"How long are you two going to keep this up? It's just to keep me sitting here. I can tell that very easily."
Insigna said hastily,
"Where will you go when you're out there?"
"Just around. To the little river, or creek, or whatever it is."
"Why?"
"Because it's interesting. Just flowing water in the open. and you can't see the ends, and you know it's not being pumped back to the beginning.
But it is, said Insigna, by the heat of Nemesis.
That doesn't count. I mean, human beings aren't doing it. Besides, I just want to stand there and watch it.
Don't drink from it, said Insigna severely.
I don't intend to. I can last an hour without drinking. If I get hungry or thirsty or anything else, I'll come back. You're making such a fuss over nothing.
Gunnar smiled. I suppose you want to recycle everything right here in the dome.
Yes, of course. Wouldn't anyone?
Gunnar's smile broadened. He said, you know, Eugenia, I'm quite certain that living in settlements has changed humanity permanently. The necessity of cycling is now ingrained in us. On Earth, you just threw things away, assuming it would recycle naturally, and of course, sometimes it didn't.
Gunnar, said Insigna, you're a dreamer. It may be possible for human beings to learn good habits under pressure, but relieve the pressure and the bad habits are back at once. Downhill is easier than uphill. It's called the second law of thermodynamics, and if we ever do colonize Erythro, I predict that we will litter it from end to end in no time at all.
No, we won't, said Marlena. Gunnar said in a tone of polite inquiry, why not, dear? And Marlena said with impatient force,
because we won't. Now can I go out?
Gunnar looked at Insigna and said, we might as well let her go, Eugenia. We can't hold her back forever. Besides, for what it's worth, René d'Aubusson, who just got back from Rota, went over all the records from the start and told me yesterday that Marlena's brain scan seems so stable that she is convinced that Marlena will come to no harm on Erythro. Marlena, who had turned toward the door as though ready to walk to the airlock, now turned back.
Wait, Uncle Seaver, I almost forgot. You must be careful of Dr. d'Aubusson.
Why? She's an excellent neurophysicist.
That's not what I mean. She was pleased when you were in trouble after your trip outside and pretty disappointed when you got better.
Insigna looked surprised and said automatically,
what makes you say that?
Because I know.
But I don't understand that. Seaver, don't you get along with d'Aubusson?
Certainly I do. We get along very well, never a cross word. But if Marlena says, mightn't Marlena be wrong? Marlena said at once,
but I'm not.
Gunnar said, I'm sure you're right, Marlena. Then to Insigna, d'Aubusson is an ambitious woman. If anything happens to me, she's the logical choice as my successor. She's had a great deal of experience down here, and she's surely the best person to deal with the plague if it lifts its head again. What's more, she's older than I am, and may not feel there's much time to waste. I couldn't blame her if she was anxious to succeed me, and if her heart lifted a bit when I was ill. The chances are she's not even consciously aware of these feelings.
Yes, she is, said Marlena ominously. She knows all about it. You watch out, Uncle Seaver.
Well, I will. Are you ready now?
Of course I'm ready.
Then let me walk you to the airlock. You come with us, Eugenia, and try not to look so tragic. And so it was that Marlena stepped out onto the surface of Erythro, alone and unprotected for the first time. It was, by Earth Standard Time, 9:20 p.m., January 15th, 2237. By Erythro time, it was mid-morning. Chapter 30. Transition. 65. Kryl Fisher tried to suppress his excitement, tried to maintain the same calm expressions that the others were wearing. He didn't know where Tessa Wendell was at the moment. She couldn't be far, since the superluminal was reasonably small, though broken up so that someone in one bay might well be out of sight to someone in another. The other three crew members were just pairs of hands to Fisher. They each had something to do, and they were doing it. Only Fisher himself had nothing specific to do, except perhaps to be careful to stay out of the way of the others. He looked at the other three, two men and one woman, almost furtively. He knew them to talk to, and had talked to them frequently. They were all young. The oldest was Chow Li Wu, who was 38 and a hyperspatialist. Then there was Henry Jarlow, who was 35, and Mary Blankowitz, the baby of the team, 27 years old, and with the ink still damp on her doctor's diploma. Wendell, at 55, was ancient by comparison, but she was the inventor, the designer, the demigoddess of the flight. It was Fisher who was odd man out. He would be 50 on his next birthday, which was not so far off, and he had no specialized training. He had no right to be on the ship if either youth or knowledge were considered. But he had been on Rota once. That counted. And Wendell wanted him with her, and that counted even more. So did Tanayama and Korapatsky, which counted most of all. The ship was making its way, lumbering through space. Fisher could tell that, even though there was no physical indication that this was so. He could feel it with the tendrils of his intestines, if they had any. He thought fiercely, I've been in space far longer than all the others put together, far more times on far more ships. I can tell there is nothing sleek about this ship just by the feel of it. They can't. The superluminal had to lack sleekness. The normal power sources that kept ordinary spaceships moving through the vacuum were cramped and cut down in the superluminal. They had to be, for most of the ship was given over to the hyperspatial motors. It was like a seabird that waddled clumsily on land because it was designed for the water. Wendell suddenly appeared. Her hair was somewhat disheveled and she was perspiring a bit. Fisher said, Is everything all right, Tessa?
Oh, yes, perfectly.
She rested her rear end against one of the convenient wall depressions, very useful considering the light pseudo-grav maintained on the ship.
No problems.
When do we make the move into hyperspace?
In a few hours. We want to get into the proper coordinates with all appropriate gravitational sources twisting space precisely as calculated.
So we can allow for it exactly?
That's right.
Fisher said, That doesn't make hyperspatial flight sound very practical. What if you don't know where everything is? What if you're in a hurry and can't wait to calculate every gravitational twitch? Wendell looked up at Fisher with a sudden smile.
You've never asked anything like this before. Why do you ask it now?
I've never actually been on a hyperspatial flight before. The question presents itself to me with greater urgency under these conditions, you see.
This and many other such questions have presented themselves to me with the greatest possible urgency for years. Welcome to the club.
But answer me.
Gladly. In the first place, there are devices that measure overall gravitational intensity in both scalar and tensor aspects at any point in space, whether you know the neighborhood or not. The result is not quite as accurate as it would be if you painstakingly measured each gravitational source and added them together, but it is close enough, if time is precious. And if time is still more precious and you have to push the hyperspatial button, so to speak, and trust to good fortune that gravitation is not very significant and should happen to be slightly wrong, then the transition would be accompanied by something roughly equivalent to a jar, like crossing a threshold and catching the toe of your shoe on the sill. If we can avoid that, fine. But if we don't, it's not necessarily fatal. Naturally, in the first transition point, we would like it to be as smooth as possible for our psychological peace of mind, if nothing else.
What if you're in a hurry? Feel that gravitation is negligible, and it isn't.
You have to hope that that doesn't happen.
You talked about strains during transition. That means our very first transition might be fatal, even if gravity is allowed for.
Might be. But the odds against a fatal accident at any given transmission are enormous.
Even if it isn't fatal, might it not be unpleasant?
That's harder to say, because it requires a subjective judgment. Understand that there's no acceleration involved. In hyperassistance, a ship has to work its way up to light speed, and even a little beyond at intervals, by use of a low-energy hyperspatial field. Efficiency is low, speeds are high, risks are great, and frankly, I don't know what the discomforts may or may not be. In our kind of superluminal flight, using a high-energy hyperspatial field, we make the transition at normal speeds. We may be at a speed of 1,000 kilometers per second at one instant, and at the next we are going 1,000 million kilometers per second without acceleration. And since there is no acceleration, we don't feel it.
How can there be no acceleration when you increase the speed a millionfold in an instant?
Because the transition is the mathematical equivalent of acceleration. However, whereas your body responds to acceleration, it does not to transition.
But how can you tell?
By sending animals through hyperspace from one point to another. They are in hyperspace for only a brief fraction of a microsecond, but it's the transition between space and hyperspace that we worry about, and there is one in either direction in even the briefest possible passage through hyperspace.
And animals were sent?
Of course. Once they had reached the reception point, they couldn't very well tell us how things were, but there they were, totally unhurt and calm. It was clear they hadn't been harmed in any way. We tried it on dozens of animals of all kinds. We even tried it on monkeys, all of which survived perfectly, except in one case.
Ah, and what happened in that one case?
The animal was dead, grotesquely mutilated, but that was caused by a mistake in the programming.
It wasn't the transition at all. And something like that can happen to us. It's not likely, but it can. It would be equivalent to stepping over a threshold, catching the toe of your shoe on the sill, tripping, falling forward, and breaking your neck. Such things have indeed happened, but we don't expect it to happen every time we cross a threshold, all right?
I guess I don't have a choice, said Fisher grimly. All right.
2 hours and 27 minutes later, the ship crossed safely into hyperspace with no sensation whatever for anyone on board, and the first superluminal flight at speeds far beyond that of light took place. The transition, by Earth standard time, was 9:20 p.m. January 15th, 2237. Chapter 31. Name. 66.
Silence. Marlena reveled in it, all the more so because she could break it if she wished. She stooped to pick up a pebble and tossed it against a rock. It made a small thunk, then fell to the ground and was still. Having left the dome with no more clothes than she would have worn on Rota, she felt perfectly free. She had walked straight away from the dome toward the creek without even watching to check the landmarks. Her mother's last words had been a rather weak plea. Please, Marlena, remember you said you would stay inside of the dome. She had smiled briefly, but had paid no attention. She might stay in sight, but perhaps not. She did not intend to be hemmed in regardless of what promises she had been forced to make to keep the peace. After all, she was carrying a wave emitter. At any time, she could be located. She herself could use the receiving end of it to sense the direction of the dome's emitter. If she had an accident of some sort, if she fell or was somehow hurt, they could come get her. If a meteor struck her, well, she'd be dead. There would be nothing anyone could do about that, even if she were in sight of the dome. Even allowing for the disturbing thought of meteors, it was all so peaceful and wonderful on Erythro. On Rotor, it was always noisy. Wherever you went, the air quivered and shook and battered your tired ears with sound waves. It must be even worse on Earth, with its 8 billion people and trillions of animals, and its thunderstorms and wild surges of water from the sea and sky. She had once tried to listen to a recording entitled Noises of Earth, had winced at it, and had quickly had enough. But here on Erythro, there was a wonderful silence. Marlena came to the creek, and the water moved past her with a soft, bubbly sound. She picked up a jagged pebble and tossed it into the water, and there was a small splash. Sounds were not forbidden on Erythro. They were merely doled out as occasional adornments that served to make the surrounding silence more precious. She stamped her foot on the soft clay at the creek's edge. She heard a small, dull thump, and there was the vague impression of a footprint. She bent down, cupped some water in her hand, and tossed it over the soil in front of her. It moistened and darkened in spots, crimson showing against pink. She added more water, and finally placed her right shoe on the dark spot, pressing down. When she lifted her shoe, there was a deeper footprint there. There were occasional rocks in the creek bed, and she used them as stepping stones to cross the water. Marlena kept on, walking vigorously, swinging her arms, taking in deep breaths of air. She knew very well that the oxygen percentage was somewhat lower than it was on Rota. If she ran, she would quickly grow tired, but she lacked the impulse to run. If she ran, she would use up her world more rapidly. She wanted to look at everything. She looked back, and the mound of the dome was visible, especially the bubble that housed the astronomical instruments. That irritated her. She wanted to be far enough away so that she could turn around and see the horizon as a perfect, if irregular, circle, with no intrusion of any sign of humanity, except herself, anywhere. Should she call the dome? Should she tell her mother she would be out of sight for a little while? No, they would just argue. They could receive her carrier wave. They would be able to tell that she was alive, well, and moving around. If they called her, she decided she would ignore them. Really, they must leave her to herself. Her eyes were adjusting to the pinkness of Nemesis and of the land around her in every direction. It was not merely pink. It was all in darks and lights, in purples and oranges, almost yellows in some places. In time, it would become a whole new palette of colors to her heightened senses, as variegated as Rota, but more soothing. What would happen
If someday people settled on Erythro, introduced life, built cities, would they spoil it? Or would they have learned from Earth, and would they go about it in a different way, taking this new untouched world and making it into something close to their heart's desire? Whose heart's desire? That was the problem. Different people would have different ideas, and they would quarrel with each other and pursue irreconcilable ends. Would it be better to leave Erythro empty? Would that be right, when people might enjoy it so? Marlena knew well that she didn't want to leave it. It warmed her, being on this world. She didn't know quite why, but it felt more like home than Rotor ever had. Was it some dim, atavistic memory of Earth? Was there a feeling for a huge, endless world in her genes, a longing that a small artificial turning city in space could not fulfill? How could that be? Earth was surely different from Erythro in every possible way but the similarity of size. And if Earth were in her genes, why wouldn't it be in the genes of every human being? But there must be some explanation. Marlena shook her head as though to clear it, and whirled around and around as if she were in the midst of endless space. Strange that Erythro didn't seem barren. On Rota, you could see acres of grain and orchards of fruit trees and a haze of green and amber and the straight-line irregularity of human structures. Here on Erythro, however, you saw only the rolling ground interspersed with rocks of all sizes, as though strewn carelessly by some giant hand. Strange, brooding, silent shapes with rivulets of water here and there flowing around and among them. And no life at all, if you didn't count the myriads of tiny germ-like cells that kept the atmosphere full of oxygen, thanks to the energy supply of Nemesis red light. And Nemesis, like any red dwarf, would continue to pour out its careful supply of energy for a couple of 100 billion years, hoarding its energy and seeing to it that Erythro and its tiny prokaryotes were warm and comfortable through all that time. Long after Earth's sun had died and other bright stars born still later had also died, Nemesis would shine on unchanged, and Erythro would roll about Megas unchanged, and the prokaryotes would live and die, also essentially unchanged. Surely human beings would have no right to come to this unchanging world and change it. Yet if she were alone on Erythro, she would need food and companionship. She might return to the dome now and then for supplies, or to refresh her need to see other people, but she could still spend most of her time alone with Erythro. But would not others follow? How could she prevent them? And with others, no matter how few, would not Eden inevitably be ruined? Wasn't it being ruined because she herself had entered Eden? Only she? No, she shouted it. She shouted it loudly in a sudden, eager experiment to see if she could make the alien atmosphere tremble and force it to carry words to her ears. She heard her own voice, but in the flat terrain there were no echoes. Her shout was gone as soon as it sounded. She whirled again. The dome was just a thin shadow on the horizon. It could almost be ignored, but not quite. She wished it was not visible at all. She wanted nothing in view but herself and Erythro. She heard the faint sigh of the wind and knew it had picked up speed. It was not strong enough to feel, and the temperature hadn't dropped, nor was it unpleasant. It was just a faint, ah. She imitated it cheerfully. Ah. Marlena stared up at the sky curiously. The weather forecasters had said it would be clear that day. Was it possible for storms to blow up suddenly and unpredictably on Erythro? Would the wind rise and become uncomfortable? Would clouds whip across the sky and rain begin to fall before she could get back to the dome? That was silly as the meteors. Of course it rained on Erythro, but right now there were only a few wispy pink clouds above. They moved lazily against the dark and unobstructed sky. There didn't seem to be any sign of a storm. Ah, whispered the wind. Ah, I. It was a double sound, and Marlena frowned. What could be making that sound? Surely the wind could not make the sound by itself. It would have to pass some obstruction and whistle as it did so. But there was nothing of the sort within sight. Ah. It was a triple sound now, with the stress on the second sound. Marlena looked around, wondering. She couldn't tell where it was coming from. To make the sound, something had to be vibrating, but she saw nothing, felt nothing. Erythro looked empty and silent. It could make no sound.
Ah-ay-ya.
Again, clearer than before. It was as though it were in her own head, and at that thought, her heart seemed to contract and she shivered. She felt the goose flesh rise on her arms. She didn't have to look. Nothing could be wrong with her head. Nothing. She was waiting to hear it again, and it came, louder, still clearer. Suddenly, there was a ring of authority to it, as though it were practicing and growing better. Practicing? Practicing what? And unwillingly, entirely unwillingly, she thought, it's as though someone who can't sound consonants is trying to say my name. As though that were a signal, or her thought had released another spasm of power, or had perhaps sharpened her imagination, she heard,
Marlena.
Automatically, without knowing she was doing it, she lifted her hands and covered her ears. Marlena, she thought, soundlessly. And then came the sound, mimicking,
Marlena.
It came again, almost easily, almost naturally.
Marlena.
She shuddered and recognized the voice. It was Orinel, Orinel of Rota, whom she hadn't seen since the day on Rota when she told him that the earth would be destroyed. She had thought of him hardly at all since then, but always achingly when she did. Why was she hearing his voice where he was not, or hearing any voice where all was not?
Marlena.
And she gave up. It was the erythro plague that she had been so certain would not touch her. She was running blindly, blindly toward the dome, not pausing to tell where it was. She did not know that she was screaming. 67. They had brought her in. They had sensed her sudden approach at a run. Two guards in E-suits and helmets had moved out at once, and they had heard her screaming. But the screaming had stopped before they had reached her. The running had slowed and stopped, too, and that was before she seemed aware of their approach. When they reached her, she looked at them quietly and amazed them by asking, "What's wrong?" No one had answered. A hand reached out for her elbow, and she whipped away. "Don't touch me," she said. "I'll go to the dome if that's what you want, but I can walk." And she had walked quietly back with them. She was quite self-possessed. 68. Eugenia Insigna, lips dry and pale, was trying not to seem distraught. "What happened out there, Marlena?" Marlena said, her dark eyes wide and unfathomable.
"Nothing.
Nothing at all. Don't say that. You were running and screaming." "I may have been, for a little while, but just for a little while. You see, it was quiet. So quiet that after a while I felt as though I must be deaf. Just silence, you know. So I stamped my feet and ran just to hear the noise, and I screamed."
"Just to hear the noise of it?" asked Insigna, frowning.
"Yes, Mother." "Do you expect me to believe that, Marlena? Because I don't. We picked up the screams, and those were not the screams of making noise. They were screams of terror. Something had frightened you.
I told you. The silence. The possibility of deafness."
Insigna turned to Dobisson. "Isn't it possible, Doctor, that if you don't hear anything, anything at all, and if you're used to hearing things all the time, then your ears might just imagine they're hearing something so they can feel useful?"
Dobisson forced a thin smile.
"That's a colorful way of putting it, but it is true that sensory deprivation can produce hallucinations."
"That disturbed me, I suppose. But after I heard my own voice and my own footsteps, I quieted down. Ask the two guards who came to get me. I was perfectly calm when they arrived, and I followed them into the dome with no trouble. Ask them, Uncle Seaver."
Gunnar nodded. "They've told me this, and we watched it happen, besides."
"Very well, then, that's it."
"That's not it at all," said Insigna, her face still white, from fright or anger or both. "She's not going out anymore. The experiment is finished."
"No, Mother," said Marlena, outraged.
Dobisson raised her voice as though to forestall any angry clash of wills between mother and daughter. She said,
"The experiment is not finished, Dr. Insigna. Whether she goes out again or not is beside the point. We still have to deal with the consequences of what has happened."
"What do you mean?" demanded Insigna.
"I mean,
It's all very well to talk about imagining voices because the ear is not accustomed to silence. But surely another possible reason for imagined voices is the onset of a certain mental instability.
Insigne looked stricken.
Marlena said loudly, "Do you mean the erythro plague?"
"I don't mean that particularly, Marlena," said d'Aubusson. "We don't have any evidence, only a possibility. So we need another brain scan. It's for your own good."
"No," said Marlena.
"Don't say no," said d'Aubusson. "It's a must. We have no choice. It's something we'll have to do."
Marlena looked at d'Aubusson out of her dark and brooding eyes. She said, "You're hoping I have the plague. You want me to have the plague."
D'Aubusson stiffened and her voice cracked.
"That's ridiculous. How dare you say such a thing?"
But it was Gunnar now who was staring at d'Aubusson.
He said, "René, we've discussed this little point about Marlena, and if she says you want her to have the plague, you must have given yourself away in some way. That is, if Marlena is serious and isn't just saying it out of fright or anger."
"I'm serious," said Marlena. "She was just bubbling with hopeful excitement."
"Well, René," said Gunnar a little more coldly, "are you?"
"I see what the girl means," said d'Aubusson, frowning. "I have not studied a fresh case of advanced plague in years. And in the days when I did, when the dome was primitive and had just been established, I had had virtually no appropriate devices with which to study it. Professionally, I would greatly welcome a chance to make a thorough study of a case of the plague with modern techniques and instrumentation, to find out, perhaps, the true cause, the true cure, the true prevention. It's a reason for excitement, yes. It is a professional excitement that this young woman, unable to read minds and without experience in such things, interprets as simple joy. It isn't simple." "It may not be simple," said Marlena, "but it's malevolent. I'm not mistaken in that."
"You are mistaken. The brain scan must and will take place."
"It will not," said Marlena, practically shouting. "You'll have to force me or sedate me, and then it won't be valid."
Insigne said, her voice shaking, "I don't want anything done against her will."
"This is something that goes beyond what she wills or does not will," began d'Aubusson,
and then staggered back with her hand to her abdomen. Gunnar said automatically, "What's the matter?" Then, without waiting for an answer, leaving it to Insigne to lead d'Aubusson to the nearest sofa and to persuade her to lie down, he turned to Marlena and said hurriedly, "Marlena, agree to the test."
"I don't want to. She'll say I have the plague."
"She won't, I guarantee that."
"Not unless you really do."
"I don't." "I'm sure you don't, and the brain scan will prove it. Trust me, Marlena, please."
Marlena looked from Gunnar to d'Aubusson and back again.
"And I can go back out on erythro again?"
"Of course. As often as you wish. If you're normal, and you're sure you're normal, aren't you?"
"Sure as anything."
"Then the brain scan will prove it."
"Yes, but she'll say I can't go out again."
"Your mother?"
"And the doctor."
"No, they won't dare stop you.
Now just say you'll allow the brain scan."
"All right. She can have it."
René d'Aubusson struggled to her feet.
69.
D'Aubusson studied the computerized analysis of the brain scan carefully while Sivir Gunnar watched.
"A curious scan," muttered d'Aubusson.
"We knew that to begin with," said Gunnar. "She's a strange young woman. The point is, there's no change?"
"None,"
said d'Aubusson.
"You sound disappointed."
"Don't start that again, Commander. There's a certain professional disappointment. I would like to study the condition."
"How do you feel?"
"I just told you. I mean physically."
"That was a strange collapse you had yesterday."
"It wasn't a collapse. It was nervous tension. I'm not often accused of wanting someone to be seriously ill and of having it apparently believed."
"What happened? An attack of indigestion?"
"Could be. Abdominal pains, in any case, and dizziness."
"Does that often happen to you, René?"
"No, it doesn't," she said sharply. "Neither am I accused of unprofessional behavior often.
Just an excitable young woman. Why did you take it so seriously?"
"Do you mind if we change the subject? She does not have any signs of brain scan change. If she was normal before, then she is still normal."
"In that case, is it your professional opinion that she may continue to explore erythro?"
"Since she has not been affected, apparently, I have no grounds on which to forbid her."
"Are you willing to go beyond that and send her out?"
D'Aubusson's attitude grew hostile. "You know that I've been to see Commissioner Pitt."
It did not sound like a question.
"Yes, I know," said Gunnar quietly. "He has asked me to head a new project designed to study the erythro plague, and there will be a generous appropriation toward that study.
I think that is a good idea, and that you are a thoroughly good choice to head the study.
Thank you. However, he did not appoint me commander in your place. Therefore, it is up to you, Commander, to decide whether Marlena Fisher can be allowed to go out on Erythro. I will confine myself to giving her a brain scan if signs of abnormality show up. I intend to give Marlena permission to explore Erythro freely whenever she wishes. May I have your concurrence in that?
Since you have my medical opinion that she does not have the plague, I will make no attempt to stop you, but the order to do so will have to be yours alone. If anything must be put into writing, you will have to sign it yourself.
But you won't try to stop me.
I have no reason to.
70. Dinner was over and soft music played in the background. Sivaganar, who had carefully talked of other things to an uneasy Eugenia Insigna, finally said, "The words are the words of René d'Aubusson, but the force behind them is that of Janus Pitt." Insigna's look of uneasiness deepened.
"Do you really think that?"
"Yes, I do. And you should. You know Janus better than I do, I think. It's too bad. René is a competent doctor, has a profound mind, and is a good person, but she's ambitious, as we all are, one way or another. And she can therefore be corrupted. She really wants to go down in history as the one who defeated the Erythro plague.
And she would be willing to risk Marlena to do it?
Not willing in the sense that she wants to, or is eager to, but willing in the sense of, well, if there's no other way.
But there must be other ways. To send Marlena into danger as an experimental device is monstrous.
Not from her standpoint, and certainly not from Pitt's. One mind is well lost if it rescues a world and makes it a fit human habitation for millions. It's a hard-hearted way of looking at it, but future generations might make a heroine out of René for being hard-hearted and agree with her that one mind was well lost, or 1,000, if that's what it would take. Yes, if it's not their minds, of course. All through history, human beings have been ready to make sacrifices at the expense of other people. Certainly Pitt would. Or don't you agree?"
"About Pitt? Yes, I do," said Insigna energetically. "To think that I worked with him all those years."
"Then you would know that he would view this in a very moralistic sense. The greatest good for the greatest number, he would say. René admits that she talked to him on her recent visit to Rotor, and I'm as positive that that's what he said to her in one form of words or another as that I am sitting in this chair."
"And what would he say," said Insigna bitterly, "if Marlena were exposed and destroyed, and the plague remained untouched? What would he say if my daughter's life were uselessly reduced to vacuity? And what would Dr. d'Aubusson say?"
"The doctor would feel unhappy, I'm sure of that."
"Because she wouldn't gain the credit for the cure?"
"Of course. But she would also feel unhappy about Marlena, and I dare say guilty. She's not a monster. As for Pitt, he is a monster. I wouldn't even say that, but he has tunnel vision. He sees only his plan for the future of Rota. If anything goes wrong, from our standpoint, he will undoubtedly tell himself that Marlena would, in any case, have interfered with his plans, and he will consider all to have happened for the good of Rota. It will not hang heavily on his conscience." Insigna shook her head slightly.
"I wish we were making a mistake, that Pitt and d'Aubusson were not guilty of such things."
"I too wish that. But I am willing to trust Marlena and her body language insights. She said that René was happy at the possibility that she would have a chance to study the plague. I accept Marlena's judgment in this."
"D'Aubusson said she was happy for professional reasons," Insigna said.
"Actually, I can believe that in a way. After all, I'm a scientist, too."
"Of course you are," said Gunnar, his homely face crinkling into a smile. "You were willing to leave the solar system and go on an untried trip across the light years to gain astronomical knowledge, even though you knew it might mean the death of every person on Rotor."
"A very small chance, it seemed to me." "Small enough to risk your one-year-old child. You might have left her with your stay-at-home husband and made sure of her safety, even though it would have meant you would never see her again. Instead, you risked her life, not even for the greater good of Rotor, but for the greater good of yourself."
Insigna said, "Stop it, Seaver. That's so cruel."
"I'm just trying to show you that almost everything can be looked at from two opposing sets of views, given sufficient ingenuity."
"Yes, d'Aubusson calls it professional pleasure at being able to study the disease, but Marlena said the doctor was being malevolent. And again, I trust Marlena's choice of words."
Then I suppose, said Insigne, the corners of her mouth curving downward, that she is anxious to have Marlena go out on Erythro again.
I suspect she does, but she is cautious enough to insist that I give the order and even suggests I put it in writing. She wants to make sure that it is I, not she, who gets the blame if something goes wrong. She's beginning to think like Pitt. Our friend Janus is contagious.
In that case, Seaver, you mustn't send Marlena out. Why play into Pitt's hands?
On the contrary, Eugenia, it's not simple at all. We must send her out.
What?
There's no choice, Eugenia, and no danger to her. You see, I now believe you were right when you suggested there was some permeating life form on the planet that could exert some sort of power over us. You pointed out that I was deleteriously affected, and you were, and the guard was, and always when Marlena was in any way opposed. And I just saw precisely that happen to Rene. When Rene tried to force a brain scan on Marlena, she doubled up. When I persuaded Marlena to accept the brain scan, Rene immediately improved.
Well, there you are then, Seaver. If there's a malevolent life form on the planet...
Now wait, Eugenia. I didn't say it was malevolent. Even if this life form, whatever it might be, caused the plague as you suggested it did, that stopped. You said it was because we seemed to be content to remain in the dome. But if the life form were truly malevolent, it would have wiped us out and it would not have settled for what seems to me to have been a civilized compromise.
I don't think it's safe to try to consider the actions of a totally alien life form and deduce from that its emotions or intentions. What it thinks might well be totally beyond our understanding.
I agree, Eugenia. But it's not harming Marlena. Everything it has done has served to protect Marlena, to shield her from interference.
If that's so, said Insigne, then why was she frightened? Why did she begin to run to Dome, screaming? Not for one moment do I believe her tale that the silence made her nervous, and she was just trying to make some noise to break that silence.
That is hard to believe. The point is, though, that the panic subsided quickly. By the time her would-be rescuers reached her, she seemed perfectly normal.
I would guess that something the life form had done had frightened Marlena.
I would imagine it was as unlikely to understand our emotions as we are to understand its. But seeing what it had done, it proceeded to soothe her quickly. That would explain what happened, and would demonstrate, once again, the humane nature of the life form. Insigne was frowning.
The trouble with you, Seaver, is that you have this terrible compulsion to think good of everyone and everything. I can't trust your interpretation.
Trust or not, you will find we can in no way oppose Marlena. Whatever she wants to do, she will do, and the opposition will be left behind, gasping in pain or flat out unconscious.
Insigne said, but what is this life form?
I don't know, Eugenia.
And what frightens me more than anything now is, what does it want with Marlena?
Gunnar shook his head. I don't know, Eugenia. And they stared at each other, helplessly.